I want to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. We have one case on our 10 o'clock docket for oral argument. And before we get started, I'll introduce the panel that we have here today. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach. To my right is Justice Dabney Basil. And I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So I understand that all counsel have checked in with the clerk who are here to argue. So I will ask the clerk to call the case. All right, thank you. You may begin.
May it please the court. The claims asserted in this case arise out of the acquisition and operation of an oilfield trucking services business called LO Transport that my client, Mr. Larry Anders, joined together with a group of others to acquire and then operate. Mr. Anders is now defending claims against him for fraud, tortious interference, and civil conspiracy brought by the sellers of the business, Leslie and Denise Oates, as well as their son, Stetson Oates, and his company, Oates Enterprises, LLC, the appellees here. At bottom, the primary question for the court today on this appeal is whether these claims are subject to the TCPA. The Oates argument, in a nutshell, is that the TCPA simply can't apply to the claims they've asserted here against my client because they relate to alleged fraud and tortious conduct in a private business transaction, not weighty issues of the constitutional rights of association or free speech that the TCPA is ultimately designed to protect. Now, respectfully, I believe that it disregards the plain language of the statute and misconstrues the relevant case law that makes it clear that regardless of what we lawyers or judges may think of the wisdom of the statute enacted by the legislature, the claims against Mr. Anders here are subject to the TCPA. In their brief, the Oates cite and attach the legislature's recent bill amending the TCPA, which took effect just last month. It doesn't apply to this appeal, but I think it's instructive because it actually underscores that the TCPA is originally enacted had a broad reach that could encompass private communications relating to private business transactions. In fact, the extraordinarily broad application prompted the legislature to revise the statutory definitions that we're here talking about today to substantially limit the applicability of the statute going forward. Appendix C to the Oates brief reflects the legislative intent of the amended statute. And to quote from that, one of the senators said regarding the definition of public concern the following: under current law, lawyers and judges can apply the definition to almost any type of human activity. The definition of public concern goes way beyond what the U.S. protects as speech about a public concern. Continuing on talking about the bill to amend the statute, he continued, under the bill, the issue must be something that matters to the public at large. Statements made in private matters to a limited group of people would not be covered by the definition. As those materials make clear, the legislature recently recognized that the statute that they had originally enacted included very broad provisions that lent themselves to extensive application of the TCPA.
If I could interrupt?
Yes, Your Honor.
Tell me how, regardless of what some senators said during the legislative process on the new provisions, talk to us about how the facts of this case either fit into or don't fit into the Kokak case, the Erdner case, and the Dyer case.
Yes, Your Honor. As far as the Kokak case, I know that the Justice Basil authored the opinion on that. As an initial matter on the Kokak case, the holding is actually quite narrow. That given the plain meaning of common, the TCPA's right of association definition requires more than two tortfeasors conspiring to act tortiously for their own selfish benefit. That's not our position here. Unlike Kokak, we are not trying to meet our burden on the first prong of the TCPA test by just saying that the Oates alleged conspiracy claim to commit these torts between my client, Mr. Anders, and one of the other individuals that's been sued for conspiracy, and therefore we have the requisite common interest. The common interest we have here is not the commission of a tort. The common interest was the acquisition and operation of LO Transport. And further, we're not talking about just two tortfeasors who allegedly joined together to commit a tort here. We're talking about a larger group, a of individuals who join together to pursue a legitimate common interest, namely the acquisition and operation of the business. And to be clear, that group included not just Mr. Anders and Mr. Jonathan Kalura. It also includes Stetson Oates, one of the appellees, who became an owner of the company along with Mr. Anders and Mr. Kalura when they acquired LO Transport.
But haven't subsequent cases to ours, like I'm thinking of a couple from the Dallas Court of Appeals, sort of gone beyond this view that, okay, if you only have two people that are conspiring, then that's not under the TCPA, but haven't courts taken a sort of a broader view that recognizes that perhaps the TCPA as written originally could sweep in all these things under the right of association concept, but that as I think Justice Basil wrote, is really kind of an outlier when you look at the overall purpose of the TCPA and the fact that the other rights mentioned do have some very clear connection with what we think of as broader constitutional rights.
Yes, with respect to the Dyer case and the subsequent cases out of the Dallas Court of Appeals, I think two observations on those, Your Honor. With respect to Dyer, that, like the Kalchak case, you had a movement arguing that because I'm alleged to have conspired or communicated with this other individual to misappropriate trade secrets, it satisfies the common interest prong. Again, that's not the issue here. The Dallas Court of Appeals did not utilize the same reasoning as Justice Basil in reaching the conclusion, but not surprisingly found that the TCPA can't reach that far. It's an absurd result that would be contrary to the very purpose of the statute, to protect tortious or illegal conduct. Now, the subsequent Dallas Court of Appeals cases don't all involve necessarily that situation, Erdner being one of them, where there is a question as to what the individuals joined together to do. Was it to commit a tort, as the plaintiffs alleged, or was it for other interest, other legitimate explanations for why they joined together, as the movement alleged? I think in that case, it's telling that Justice Whitehill wrote a concurring opinion as to that, explaining that he concurred in the result as to the right of association, not because he agreed with it, but because that was the precedent of the Dallas Court of Appeals from back in the Coleman case, which eventually went up to the Texas Supreme Court. When the Texas Supreme Court decided the Coleman case, it only looked at the free speech prong, didn't reach the right of association prong, and therefore the Coleman opinion from the Dallas Court of Appeals remains binding on that district until reversed by a higher authority or the court sitting en banc. Justice Whitehouse said that he believes that Coleman, as to the right of association, was, given the Supreme Court's announcement in Exxon v. Coleman, decided incorrectly because it added a requirement to the statute that isn't there, that it concerns some element of public or citizens' participation. With respect to the claims that are brought here, that the Oates brought against Mr. Anders, it's important to differentiate here between the claims asserted by the different appellees because even though they've all asserted the same causes of action, the factual basis for their claims differ in material respects that affect the analysis of TCPA applicability. With the claims brought by the sellers of the business, Leslie and Denise Oates, those claims primarily arise out of alleged misrepresentations that they would receive $11 million in connection with the sale. Now, the Oates primary argument appears that the right of association under the TCPA required the communication or shared interest relate to public or citizen participation. For that, they rely on the cases we just discussed, Kalchak, Dyer, and the other recent Dallas Court of Appeals cases. For the reasons I explained previously, I don't believe that those cases mandate the denial of Mr. Anders' motion here, both because some of them were more limited and because I respectfully believe the Dallas Court of Appeals, the prior precedent that was decided before the Supreme Court announced its ruling in Coleman, mandates a different result. In Coleman, the Supreme Court, addressing the free speech prong, took a very broad read of the rights at issue and did not read a public or citizens' participation requirement into the statute.
Well, do you think that Mr. Anders could just have a good, solid summary judgment motion to file?
I certainly think he does, Your Honor, but the whole purpose of the TCPA is to allow an expedited procedure for parties that have been sued on meritless claims to get out of the lawsuit before they have to expend substantial amounts. now it's fighting against the meritless claims. And so because we believe it applies here, yes, we think down the road, if this court were to affirm and we were to be remanded back, that we would have a very good summary judgment motion to pursue in the future, certainly, Your Honor. Under a different standard, I recognize certainly that the second prong, the second step of the TCPA test is not identical to the summary judgment standard. They have a low burden on the second step. I don't think they meet that here, so I certainly think they wouldn't be able to meet that for a summary judgment. Now, I would also note that Leslie and Denise Oates' claims are also subject to the TCPA under the free speech prong, Your Honor. Contrary to what the Oates contend in their brief, that's not an argument that's been waived, and we've explained that in our briefing. But I think under the broad definition of matter of public concern, is the statute defined prior to the recent amendments restricting the application to no longer include economic well-being, because that's one of the amendments the legislature recently enacted. The alleged communications to the Oates regarding the millions of dollars they would receive in the transaction meets the required criteria.
Well, there's some precedent of this court that looks that kind of restricts how integral the communication has to be before the free speech prong is invoked. How do you feel about, how do you distinguish those cases?
Well, I think as far as if it's integral to the claims, I think it certainly is here. The claim at issue that Leslie and Denise Oates, as opposed to the other appellees, assert is based on a representation that they would get $11 million in this transaction. That's the brief foundation of their claims. So if that communication relates to a matter, is made in connection with a matter of public concern, it comes within the ambit of the statute. And your matter of public concern is defined to include, among other things, matters relating to economic well-being. In the Coleman case, which addressed this issue in the Texas Supreme Court, the court found that a report or statements made in connection with a report into whether an activity had occurred met the free speech problem, the matter of public concern definition, because it related to an effort to reduce economic risks, which underscores the very broad application that the statute in its original state had. With the limited time I have left, I'll now turn briefly to the claims brought by Stetson Oates and his entity, Oates Enterprises, because although those claims are substantially similar to each other, they're quite different from what Leslie and Denise Oates have asserted in this case. Stetson's claims can be put into two buckets. First, we have the claims that are based on alleged misrepresentations made prior to the closing of the transaction. Stetson and his company alleged that Anders made two representations to him pre-closing. One, regarding the funding of the acquisition, that financing wouldn't be required. And two, regarding the availability of funds for subsequent operations, that we'll have enough money to make this a successful operation. The second bucket of Stetson's claims are based on Anders' alleged involvement behind the scenes at LO after the consummation of the acquisition. In essence, Stetson and his company, in furtherance of their tortious interference and certain fraud claims, complain of certain actions and representations that were supposedly made in the months after the acquisition. And he alleges that Mr. Anders was behind the scenes telling Mr. Kalua and Mr. Show Me Roy what to do and to say those things. Now, given that Stetson, Anders, and Kalua were all partnering together to acquire and operate LO as the company's owners, I think both the pre- and the post-closing theories asserted by Stetson squarely fit within the statutory definition of the right of association. But moreover, these alleged representations and communications that Stetson bases his claims and Oates Enterprises' claims on plainly concern matters relating to economic well-being. The very communications that underlies claims relate to that. And so we think that also meets the TCPA's definition for the right of free speech. Well, in closing, we believe we established that the TCPA applies to Appellee's claims against Mr. Anders, and that there is not clear and specific evidence establishing a prima facie case on each element. If the court has any further questions, I'll be glad to answer them. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you. Before you begin, counsel, just a point of clarification. I know that when the clerk told us who had checked in, we were told that you were going to argue for 10 minutes. Are you going to have co-counsel arguing?
I do now, Your Honor. I'll take 10 minutes and counsel for Stetson Oates. And
Your Honor, I apologize for being late. Our building was struck by the tornado.
Oh, sorry.
Our servers were down yesterday until about 7:50 last night. So I will defer to him today. I tried to go by and pick up some stuff, but I just couldn't make it.
So I apologize. No, those of us who were in Fort Worth back in 2000 know exactly what you have gone through, so I'm sorry to hear that. All right, Mr. Lindsay.
I just have the paper, not a pad. I apologize.
That is not a problem at all. I just wanted to make sure that we knew what...
We accept the tornado at your homework.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Hopefully never again.
Yes, hopefully never again.
All right, Mr. Lindsay.
Yes, yeah, sorry, but let me be clear. How much time do you want? I mean,
just you take whatever you need.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
If they have any questions
then,
for me, I will have to answer.
Okay. Then I'll, if I may, I'll take the 15 if I need it. The 15, if I can. That's what I'm understanding.
Okay.
Yes.
We'll
and
get
then
through this.
I'll try to stop early so if the court has questions for Mr. Harris.
All right. Thank you.
We did a lot before I got to say, may it please court, counsel. We're, as the court knows, we're here today because the trial court, I think, properly denied the motion to dismiss. Our clients are Leslie and Denise Oates, that were the prior owners of LO Transport, the ones who sold this business to one of the SAF entities. As former Justice Pittman wrote almost a year ago to the day, we are here again exploring the farthest reaches of the TCPA, except this one is a little different because there are multiple opinions from this court and the Dallas court and others that say this is too far. Too far. We can talk about how broad the act is all day long, but when we've got a clear authority that tells us this reaches too far, we know what the result should be.
So do you think,
yes.
Do you think, counsel, that it's the proper role of the judiciary if the legislature wrote a statute that on its face says something more than anybody in this room might think it should have said? Do we have the authority to ignore the plain language that the legislature chose to use?
No, Your Honor, I don't think you do. But as the CAWCAC, and I still don't know how to pronounce that case, but
we never figured it out either.
CAWCAC is how I started. That's how I finished. As that opinion reflects, and as others do, there is a way to follow the plain meaning of the statute to express that legislative intent and still give it extremely broad application as that legislature intended, but not adding words to the statute. This case at its core is a fraud case and related cause of action, of course, but we see those things in cases all around the state. There were representations to pay $11 million. There was a side deal going on of some sort with a change deal to only pay $8 million, tried to change the deal, and there's admissions in the evidence that that Mr. Anders never intended to put that $3 million piece in.
Tell me one thing I didn't fully understand from the briefs, and this really doesn't have anything to do with the legal issue, but there was a $3 million note from Stetson to his parents. Did I read that correctly?
Later, the Oates' bank came to them, if I have this correct, the Oates' bank came to them and for some reason needed to close up the financials, and then that's where Stetson executed the $3 million promissory note over 10 years to close that $3 million gap, which of course is the same $3 million that was supposed to have already been paid within 30 days of closing with cash or cash equivalents. And that's another thing Mr. Anders admitted is, you know, interest in an entity or not, he battled about it, but those are not cash equivalents.
The promissory note from Oates Enterprises, which was a part owner of LO Transport after the sale, that would not be a cash equivalent to have a promissory note?
It differs from the purchase agreement. The purchase agreement was $3 million in cash or cash equivalents within 30 days of that sale. If I, and I may be making a mistake in the record, but I believe that promissory note follows that 30-day period, and nor do I think it fits into the even what Mr. Anders admitted was constitutes cash equivalents. Now, I want to get back a little bit to the first step of the process, because I think that's where the court just doesn't get past in this case, and I won't repeat all of the law to you because the court's well familiar with it. But
in particular, talk to us about your opposing counsel's argument about economic well-being.
Yes, there is in economic well-being. Of course, that was addressed primarily, not precisely in the Coleman case, Exxon versus Coleman as to free speech rights. That case, though, that's an easy result when you look at all the other cases, because there, if that employee, private issue involved within an entity, but if that employee doesn't do his job as he was alleged to have not done, we've got chemicals leaking on the streets, and we've got big economic issues, public safety issues. So that's one. But there are multiple other cases that don't conflict with Coleman at all on the economic well-being. One of which, and these are not in our brief because they were newer, they're brand new cases. One is the Schmidt case, Schmidt versus Crawford. 2019 TexApp Lexus 7341. That's from the First District in August of this year. That case was somebody needed a bail bond, and the bail bondsman took a lien against the filed a deed of trust, and then when he got sued later for overclaiming the rights to the lien, motion to dismiss followed. Said, well, my economic well-being is at issue because I have a right to get paid on these loans that I gave you. And the court specifically looked, similar to the Kalkak opinion, said, we've got to look at each word of the statute. They go into economic well-being, and they said that it's got to be a broader scale. There has to be some public interest involved. If we're going to talk about a matter of public concern, there has to be some level of public interest involved in that economic well-being. That exists in Coleman. We've got economic well-being for the safety of Irving or wherever that was that it fell. The second case is Reed, R-E-E-D. That's 2019 TexApp Lexus 5631. That's from Dallas in July. That was a real estate investment that went south in West Texas. And the defendants, of course, as they all seem to do, filed a motion to dismiss under the TCPA and raised the free speech argument. On that issue, the court said, again, this has to be individual litigants. Personal economic well-being does not reach the levels of the matter of public concern that's on the face of the statute. And while I'm on the free speech thing, I do think it's important for this court to address the waiver argument. This motion, I'm fine for you to address the merits too, but the right of free speech was not addressed at all in the motion to dismiss that was filed on the last day that it could have been filed. The right of free speech wasn't raised at all until 3 days before the argument in the trial court. Now, they cite to the Adams case, and yes, Adams says don't read it so narrowly on the waiver issues. But Adams does not go so far as to say ignore preservation of error in TCPA cases. What happened in Adams was you clearly had a free speech argument in the trial court, definitely had that argument, but it was different prongs of the economic well-being or community well-being. It was a subset of free speech in the economic or the well-being part that was being argued. Not, I have only put right of association in my motion to dismiss, and as I'm getting ready for the hearing, oh, that one might be a good one too. Let me add it 3 days before the hearing and long, long after the 60 days. Now, I think that, to me, the Sheffield case does not conflict. Sheffield's in our brief. It does not conflict with Adams on that issue because it says only right of association was raised in the Sheffield motion, and that's all that was preserved for appeal, right? And I think current law already covers this issue, but just as a practitioner, it would be helpful if the court had had cases that say you don't get to raise free speech 3 days before a hearing if you didn't put it in your motion to dismiss.
But Justice Blacklock's language is pretty broad in Adams about how expansive a view we're supposed
sure,
to give.
Sure, holistic view of the statute as a whole, and I think you can still do that when you talk about this. This is more like raising two completely separate affirmative defenses at trial. If you don't, if you plead one of them and not the other one, you only get to use one of them. You can do that and have that holding but also give a holistic view to the TCPA. They're just completely different arguments and grounds for relief. I do want to touch. Well, the court's well aware. One of the arguments as to the free speech on its merits, case after case, as the court's questions indicated, private communications about business disputes just do not reach the level of public concern under the free speech prong. The Erdner case, the Dyer case, and one that they tell you, Mr. Anders says, careful with that Brugger's case, because it's no good, essentially. Well, he wasn't Justice Busby yet, but Justice Busby wrote that opinion in Brugger, and I'll take my chances with him with following an opinion he wrote. Final couple of points. Standard of review the court is well aware of, but I'm not sure Anders has it right. In the reply brief, he expressly asked this court to make an objective view of the record. No dispute, de novo for does the TCPA apply, no dispute of did he meet preponderance of the evidence for whether we fall within the act, that's de novo. But once you get past that point, if you get past that point, and you shouldn't, once you get past that, it's similar to the summary judgment standards. We're the non-movements here. We get the inferences. We get the light most favorable to us. We don't take an objective view of the record. We don't do that on summary judgment. We sure don't need to do that on motions filed 60 days after you get served.
Do you agree that the way we view the non-movement's burden is the same in the TCPA case as in summary judgment, because a non-movement, unlike summary judgment, a non-movement in a TCPA case actually does have some burdens, right?
Well, okay. I liken it more to a no-evidence burden of we do have a burden to come forward with evidence as opposed to a traditional motion for summary judgment where we can, you know, stand on the arguments in the motion itself. So sure, if we get that far, we do have a burden to. I wouldn't recommend doing what someone did a few weeks ago, an opinion from this court, and only relied on their pleadings and no evidence whatsoever. Sure, we need to bring forth some evidence in addition to our pleadings to show that there's the prima facie case under the standards. But We're not here to take objective views at the evidence. We're here to see are there issues for the court to later, the jury to later decide, and that's what we've got. If this court gets as far as those issues and merits, we've got where's jury issues. What did he know? What's Anders' credibility when he denies having certain knowledge? Those are all issues for someone later to make those determinations. So. As to the merits, we'll stand on our briefs and our citations to the record. Does the court have any other questions for me?
I'm just curious whether I realize that Stetson's not your client, but are there any differences in the legal analysis between the two sets of parties that you think we need to?
I was waiting
understand?
For a question to come up that I wasn't going to totally know the answer to, and I'll be honest, Judge, I don't really know that. Perhaps I should, getting ready for this, but I don't think there are any differences in the analysis as far as does the TCPA apply, do we have a public concern or not, are we within the meaning of common within the CAWCAC opinion. I can't imagine that there are actually any differences there in the court's analysis for the other claims.
Do you have anything else?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. rebuttal?
Please, the court. Just following up on a few points made by counsel and questions posed by the panel. First, with respect to economic well-being, the position that the Oats are taking, it appears, and I haven't read the recent cases, haven't seen the ones he referred to in his argument, is that personal economic well-being doesn't meet the requirement of the statute because it's not public, and that doesn't meet the definition of matter of public concern. But if we look at the plain language of matter of public concern, the way it existed at the time this motion was filed, is that it's economic well-being. There's no public requirement to it. That's something that the legislature has now changed. It's a marked change. I think if we were deciding under the current statute, it would be a completely different question. I think a different result on that. But as it currently stands, the requirement is that it has to just be an economic, relate to a matter of economic well-being, which I think that we have met here. As far as the waiver argument goes, preservation of errors intended to make sure that the trial court is presented with the argument and an opportunity to rule on it. The free speech argument was raised before the Oats or Stetson Oats Enterprises even filed a response. They had an opportunity to respond to it. The trial court.
But would you agree that the free speech angle of this was not raised within 60 days?
It was not raised in the motion, but I'm not sure that it's required to, Your Honor. The statute itself requires that a motion be filed within 60 days. We complied with that. As far as the legal arguments, I think for the reasons we cited in our brief, number one, we did raise it with the trial court. So I think as far as preservation of error goes, it was preserved. And also looking to the court's opinion.
But the right of association analysis under the statute that existed when this lawsuit was filed seems to be different from the free speech angle, which is more closely tied to what we think of as the purpose of an anti-SLAPP statute. So, I mean, do you think it's sufficient that you amend or raise an issue like that so close in time to the hearing without its being in the original motion?
If I could make sure it was in the original motion, it would have been, certainly. It wasn't an attempt to sandbag or anything of the sort. But it's an issue that just needs to be raised with the trial court. And the motion, the TCPA statutory regime at the time in question, didn't require when it said a motion must be filed within 60 days that it must specify the particular grounds, and then you're stuck with that. It just requires that you move, and then we have the burden-shifting analysis that occurs. And at the end of the day, the courts, the Texas Supreme Court has made clear that the court is looking at holistically at the record, all the pleadings, the evidence, to determine whether the TCPA applies or de novo review. As for the standard of review, he agrees to de novo review. As far as the Oats getting inferences and not objectively viewing the evidence, I don't think it's our contention that the court looks at the evidence if it gets to the second step and doesn't give them inferences or the sort of things that have been laid out in the case law as how the second step of the analysis is conducted. But they still have the burden to come forward with some evidence on each element of the claim. So our position, for the reason we set forth in a brief, they didn't do that here. So,
give me your view of how this $3 million note integrates into this process.
Yes, Your Honor. The $3 million note fits in because it's a dispute between the parties as whether the purchase price was $11 million in cash or cash equivalents, whatever that means, to the Oats, or, as the defense side alleges, there was an agreement that it would be $8 million paid in cash after netting out liabilities, and $3 million Stetson Oats, where his entity would be responsible for, in exchange for him receiving a $3 million equity interest in the company. The promissory note at issue is dated the exact same date as the closing of the transaction, February 13, 2017. That reflects that, consistent with the defense view, that Stetson Oats, or his entity, was responsible for the payment of that $3 million. And I think that is a cash equivalent. Mr. Anders was asked about whether a limited partnership, in his deposition, was asked if a limited partnership was a cash equivalent. And he, as his counsel indicated, said no, he didn't think so. This, I think, is a cash equivalent. I think it's consistent with our version of the story, and we'll come. That's how it fits into the bigger picture, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, gentlemen, your case is submitted. Appreciate the oral argument. It's been very helpful. And with that, we're adjourned.